Welcome to the first episode of the Northwest Prevention Technology Transfer Center's Lessons in Leading podcast. These episodes spotlight leaders in prevention from communities around the region and beyond. We've asked each guest to share with us a story that has made an impact on them as a leader. Listen to hear what stories and learnings they have to share. Keep track of what resonates with you as a leader, what you want to take away, and what's still circling around with what you're hearing. We'll talk about these more during the Leadership Academy. First, in this episode, we'll hear from Val Thomas Mattson.
Well, again, my name is Val, and I like to say one of the most important things about me is I was born, reared, and raised in Seattle, Washington, and still reside in the area. So I went to school here from elementary all the way through college and graduated from Western Washington University in beautiful Bellingham with a BA in communications and a minor in early childhood development. When I think about my leadership experience, I really believe I was literally born into leadership. I was the eldest of four children, and two of my siblings actually had sickle cell anemia. And since I was the eldest, my parents raised me to be in charge and to set a good and a right example, to always take the higher ground. My dad was famous for, well, turn the other cheek, well, turn the other cheek. Ugh, I got so tired of doing that. But it really, like I said, was the foundation for, you know, looking at things from a higher level. I think in my role as the executive director now for Look, Listen, and Learn television programming, I find myself again taking a lead to produce a product that is needed, just like I had to help my parents in raising our family. And I turned to Colin Powell for his definition or some of his definitions around leadership, because he said it's the art of accomplishing more than the science of management says is possible. And I just love that, that leadership is a science, but it is also very much an art. I'm happy to share a story that comes to mind for me that points to, I feel, some success that I've experienced as a leader. And as an African-American woman in a servant leadership role, I know that it's important to hire for skill sets, for diversity of staff, for one's organizational culture, and for race and social justice. In bringing on Look, Listen, and Learn's development director, he was spot on in all of these categories, but with the skill set, he didn't have that at all. However, he'd been successful in his chosen career, and his eagerness and glee to make a change in the world of development was enticing. I brought him on, and we both experienced a high level of success. We set benchmarks for him, got him into some intensive training and mentorships, and then invited him to just jump in. He's on his way, loving his work, and he is really knocking it out of the park. And it's one of those stories, one of those success stories that just warms my heart to be able to welcome someone's eagerness and to help foster that into a strength that they didn't even know they had. What I learned about myself as a leader from this experience with our development director is that I can make good decisions, that I have a good gut, and it's okay to lean into it. I'm remembering another adage that I heard a lot growing up, and that is that skills, those can be taught, but it's hard to teach someone about integrity, sound judgment. It's hard to teach somebody how to have a high energy drive, how to have a balanced ego, how to be loyal, and how to have a drive about getting things done. You know, those are the things that it's really hard to teach. So I think as leaders, it's really essential that we find a place within ourselves that we can turn to and trust our own decisions. And most of them will probably be right. And those that are wrong or not right, we can correct those.
Thank you, Val. Next, we have Mickey Lansing.
My name is Mickey Lansing Lures. I have been in several different positions. I worked in the private sector until 1981, 10 years for a non-ferrous scrap metal firm that recycled and exported non-ferrous scrap metal, mainly to Japan and Korea. And I was in charge of the administrative functions, and then we had three unions where I did the union negotiations for them. Left in 1981 and adopted two children, and so spent time at home. Then I went back to work in 1987 as the director of the Lutheran Office of Public Policy. In our role, we were part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. We had 17 state public policy offices, one in Washington, D.C., and we advocated on behalf of economic issues. So I did that until 1994, where I went to work for the state for a new agency called the Oregon Commission on Children and Families that was made up of a state policy body like a children's cabinet. Every one of our 36 counties in Oregon had a local commission on children and families, and then we had a state office. So that was sort of a three-legged stool. And I was there for 17 years. 16 of those years were either as the deputy or as the director of that agency. So I've been retired. Before I retired, I submitted a proposal to Casey Family Programs in Seattle, worked with SDRG and University of Washington, Ben DeHaan at Partners for Our Children. We had a partnership with Casey, our Department of Human Services, and the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. And I just actually retired from that about 5 months ago. So here I am. I do no more consulting. I actually am the chair of the board for a group in Oregon called Prevent Child Abuse Oregon. We are associated with Prevent Child Abuse America organization out of Chicago. That's a little bit about me.
Thank you, Mickey. And what story do you have to share with us?
Let's see, there are several. One of the things, and when I worked for the Lutheran Office on Public Policy, and that was from 1987 to 1994, we were really successful in two areas. Number one, raising the minimum wage in the state of Oregon, and I was one of the primary people out of three people to actually Oregon having the highest minimum wage of all the states. And that was very successful. I think though that, you know, in Oregon, we have a short session and a long session, but then our legislative sessions were every other year. And in 1989, working for Lutheran Public Policy, I did my research during the interim and found that Oregon was one of only two states that did not have a housing trust fund. And we knew that affordable housing was really, really needed for a variety of reasons. So I worked with, I called another of my colleagues and said, we need to be working on this issue. We need to start now. And we developed a coalition. And that coalition was all the people who did the advocacy. We called them the whiners and the criers, you know, but all the religious groups, nonprofits, et cetera. But then all the business community, the homeowners, the Oregon Banking Association, Oregon Mortgage Association, the realtors. And we decided at that first meeting, and what was so impactful for me there was that we started the meeting by asking each person sitting around the table to say What was it that motivated them to accept mine and Peter, the other man, my partner, in creating this coalition? What was it that made you accept that invitation? And without exception, each one said that they had a personal experience with either a relative or a child or a parent where they were in terms of being able to access affordable housing, and it was so important to them. When we formed then our coalition, we decided that we were not going to take on any other issue but the issue of developing a housing trust fund. And we were able to keep that group together, people who were many times on different sides of an issue, stayed together, developed relationships. We worked cohesively. And in the 1991 legislative session, we were able to get $25 million out of the legislature to start a housing trust fund, where we would keep so much, we put some aside, but the rest we would use the interest off of that. And so that was something, it was a huge, huge, I think, victory for the advocacy committee. And it's really true when you say it takes a village, because everybody had their own particular role and function, and not one person veered from what our initial agreements were with one another. So we developed a common understanding, a common vision, and then we just continued to work together. And so I would have to say that's one of the outstanding experiences I've had, because I believe when you get such a diverse group of people together who work on so many different issues and many that are in conflict with one another, we were totally together and we succeeded. You know what I learned is, I think the biggest thing was I was able to truly develop a substantive relationship with some of my colleagues, lobbied also, but were on very different, as I said, sides of the coin than I was. And that I was able to listen to hear in terms of what their issues were, how they felt about that, what, you know, the ramifications were, all the different pieces of why they believed in what it was they believed in. I found that to be one of the most helpful things that I've ever experienced.
Thank you. And next we'll hear from Colleen Haggerty.
I have been a leader on and off, well, really my whole career. My first job out of college was as a camp director for summer camp for children with incredibly significant mental and physical disabilities. And from there, I've just been a leader the whole time, either in mid-management or as an executive director, all at nonprofits. And currently, I am a coach. I'm a mental health coach and do some private coaching for people around thriving in their third act and forgiveness.
Welcome, Colleen. And what leadership story would you like to share with us today?
Well, I would have to say it was that first summer at summer camp. And it was, like I said, significantly disabled folks, children. And I had a lot of staff, as you can imagine. And one of the staff that I had was an RN, because there was meds morning, noon, and night to give the children for their physical and mental health needs. And she was getting about 4 hours sleep a night, because dispensing meds took so much time. And then, of course, she had to chart everything. So this was an incredibly taxing position. And I had really no idea that it was so taxing. But I do know she came to me once and said, you know, there was a med error at dinner tonight. It wasn't life-threatening, but I do need to let you know about it. And I needed to let my supervisor know about it. So I was in Podunk, Idaho, on a lake, and he was in Seattle area. I called him and let him know. And his response was, okay, fire her. get her out of there tonight, take her to the airport. We'll figure out a nurse to get there by morning. And I was like, what? Now, this is back in the late 80s, so no way, you know, for immediate anything. And she was a woman in her 60s, late 50s from California. So I tried to say something and he was like, if you don't fire her, I will. Which meant he would also be firing me. That was clear. And to save my job, I went down and I fired her. And I was crying and she was crying. And I found a camp counselor to take her to the airport. Well, they got a nurse overnight. You know, I felt horrible about it. And at the end of the summer, I found out that that young camp counselor did not take her to the airport. He took her to his parents' home in Spokane. And they gave her a bed for the night. And they helped her call the airport and find a flight home the next day. They fed her breakfast. And that this 18-year-old counselor had more compassion for this woman than I did was a pivotal moment for me. That was when I knew I'm either going to lead with the understanding of every person's humanity, or I am going to, I can't lead. I can't do it the way I just did it. I can't do it because I was told to. I have to bring my humanity to the position. And I spent my whole career in management, and I spent all of that time learning how to do that. It was a journey. Every job taught me more and more about how to be a compassionate leader while also holding people accountable and, you know, meeting the bottom line. But really, compassionate leadership felt really important to me. That experience itself taught me that each person comes to their job as a person, a full person. I didn't take into account that it was the middle of the night when we were driving her to the, when I thought she was being driven to the airport, that she was from out of town, that she didn't know how to manage these things on her own. She didn't have a lot of skills in that way. So knowing that people are full people, so in subsequent years, it's like people come to work and they're stressed and, you know, it might be about home life. And we tell people to leave it at the door, but people don't leave it at the door and they can't always leave it at the door. So really engaging in my staff as full people, but that means I need to know them. And so that was something I learned over the course of time, is that I first needed to learn and understand myself and what I was bringing to the leadership table. Who am I in this role? It was critical that I knew who I was. And so there was lots of self-reflection in every job, including that one. But I also needed to know, you know, who my staff were, more than just their position, more than just their job description, but who were they outside of work that they wanted to share with me, of course. I wasn't prying or getting into their business, but I needed to know that they're full people and that they bring all of that to the table. Also then, in knowing my staff, I feel like that's how I could help develop them. Later in my career, as I felt more and more comfortable in my role as a leader, it was one of the greatest joys I had, was developing my staff. I just loved that opportunity to bring more opportunities to them so that they could develop their skills and feel better about themselves and have a wider breadth and depth of understanding of who they are in their roles and where they want to go with their life. So that felt really fun and exciting to me. But in order to do that, I needed to know myself well enough to let my ego get out of the way. And then I needed to know my staff well enough in order to know where their strengths were and what strengths I could capitalize on. So it felt like it all stemmed from that one moment where I was really confronted with, what kind of leader are you going to be? Are you going to be that jack, or are you going to, you're going to come to the table with compassion for people as true humans?
Thanks, Colleen.
And next, let's meet Margaret Spearman.
Again, my name is Dr. Margaret Spearman. I am a retired faculty administrator from the School of Social Work, the University of Washington. I've been in social work education for over the last 34 years and had the pleasure of serving in four different universities. I'm also an associate minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. I think one of the most proudest things that I could share is that I'm the mother of a loving and responsive son and daughter-in-law and three grandchildren who are my special gifts. I also co-lead a consulting LLC with my brother entitled Inclusive Engagements.
Thank you, Margaret. And what story do you have to share with us today?
You know, I think one of the just highlights of my career in the School of Social Work was when the community called upon the school. Community called upon the school to come out and help address the issues of prevention in their community. It was a time when teen suicide was up, a lot of aggressive behavior being demonstrated in the schools. And lots of organizations were doing their own special thing, taking different programs, but there wasn't collaboration among those agencies. And there wasn't an agenda for that community. And what they called upon the School of Social Work is, come help us to look at prevention strategies, to look at the evidence-based research and practices and programs, and to help us coordinate a vision for this community so that we can promote healthy youth behaviors. I think I considered myself a facilitator of change and transformation and a high regard for evidence-based programs. But what I learned, I think the most salient learning, was change takes time. And the building of relationships is critical. Being an effective listener, being intentional and committed to being a learner, and being culturally responsive.
Thank you. Coming up next, we have Joan Sharp.
Well, personally, I've lived in Seattle now. I've lived in Seattle or the Pacific Northwest for most all of my life. I finished off my career in Washington, D.C., spent 5 years there, and then returned to this area. I'm a mom and a stepmom. I'm a product of the 60s. I'm an English major. I started out in newspaper world, PR, which led me to grant writing, which led me into the world of mental health, which led me to the prevention work that I did, primarily because my experience supporting the work of the Community Mental Health Center taught me that there are children as young as 4 or 5 years old who already need intensive mental health services, which felt wrong to me. So I, from that point, moved into the early childhood family support arena. I was the executive director of a small rural early childhood family support center and then worked at the regional level with a United Way early childhood initiative. And from there moved into state level work with directing a small state prevention agency, which was a gubernatorial appointment, and worked there for the longest stretch of my career, almost a decade. And from there worked at the national and federal level, finishing up as a consultant and providing technical assistance and support for the Federal Children's Bureau, which is part of ACF at the HHS.
Thanks, Joan. And what's an experience that was impactful for you as a leader?
I've been thinking about this question since you posed it, and I arrived at the decision to tell kind of a complicated story. I'll try and keep it brief because who needs all the details, right? And after thinking it through, I thought, well, what's that story really about? And I realized fundamentally it's about the issue of competition. And competition is kind of a strange concept to think about in the prevention arena, because the primary competition I think that most leaders in the prevention arena find themselves in is for funding. And that's always the case. But in terms of positioning in the field, there's also that kind of competition. So that's what this story is about. I mentioned that I had worked as the director of a small state prevention agency. Our focus was on child abuse prevention. So we were always in competition for resources, public funding. When you think about the issue of child abuse, most people default immediately to child protective services or foster care. I think we all know, as with most other prevention-focused efforts, it's never about one thing. So the families whose children were becoming engaged in the child protective services system or ended up in foster care were typically those that were under-resourced, who were socially isolated, where there were mental health or substance abuse issues or other complicated real-life challenges that families face. But our challenge as a prevention-focused agency was to try and get people to look away from the end result and look upstream to sort of how to prevent all of those negative experiences that resulted in children being removed from their families. So the context for all that work was political because we were a state agency. And relatively early on in my experience with this agency, state revenues took a dive and the governor proposed the agency for elimination because, after all, who needs prevention, right? So there was a big scramble to save it and we were successful that time around. We got some advice after that from political operators. You know, the best thing to do is keep your head down. Don't be visible and then you won't get your head chopped off when the state budget takes a dive. But instead, after living through all that and trying to figure out how to really fulfill our mission, we decided to really opt for a bold vision. And at the time, the science in our arena was pointing us in the direction of a particular set of programs, probably familiar to many of your audience, of evidence-based home visiting. And our agency had built its reputation on our work deep in the community. We weren't just a funder. We weren't just a source of press releases and parent information. We were really engaged with our communities in terms of what their experiences were, what their issues were, and how they were solving them. So it was a challenge to think about how to take a program or a set of programs that were truly evidence-based, had received enough research to know that they were going to be effective if applied correctly, if done correctly, and integrate that into our community base. But we spent a fair amount of energy doing that, and we found willing partners all over our state who were anxious to do right by their community, to pay attention to the science, and also to work with us to figure out how to deliver quality programs, which was going to be a major challenge, I think, for all of us. This was definitely not keeping our head down. We stepped out, asked for a significant increase in our public funding to be able to support these communities in taking on these evidence-based home visiting programs. And we were lucky enough to get a down payment on the system that we envisioned, and we got underway, and we had very promising early results. But then what happened was big money came into the picture. It wasn't state money. It wasn't public money. It was a major Seattle-based philanthropic organization that had money to put in the field and wanted to make a splash. So they invested in building out a new, very high-profile, high-prestige organization, staffed it, or rather recruited a number of high-profile individuals to sit on its board. And they looked around to the field to see what was an opportunity, and they saw our work and thought, that's great, let's do that. And they put their stake in the ground and basically positioned themselves as being the only entity capable of delivering on the promise of these evidence-based home visiting programs. Long story short, there was a lot of back and forth about how this all could work and what the potential for cooperation might be, how we could collaborate, how we could work together, how we could leverage the best of both worlds, the public and the privately funded. And eventually, what happened was this organization really decided there wasn't room for both of us in this arena and maneuvered the work to their program, to their organization. And the next time that the state had a chance to do something about this sort of politically messy situation, because of the, again, pressure on the state budget, they decided to eliminate our state agency that had been focused very much on prevention work for many years with the deep support of the community. What's the learning there? What's the lesson there? Well, first of all, I guess the most prominent lesson is, ironically, about 10 years after this organization was formed, it basically went out of business. The spotlight got taken off of it. Some of the private money moved away from it. The hot topic was no longer evidence-based home visiting. It lost its cachet and it's now out of business. Now, evidence-based home visiting is still going on in the state of Washington, but it's not going on in the way that we had originally envisioned it, which I think is a significant loss because it's not deeply embedded in the communities where the need is greatest. And that's kind of the message that I think that I want to deliver to prevention leaders in terms of what's standing in our way of really getting the job done. We spend a lot of energy on the political side of this equation, trying to figure out and, you know, find our allies, find our champions, et cetera. Spun our wheels a fair amount, probably to the detriment of the agencies, the community-based agencies that we had been supporting, in the sense that our eyes got taken off the prize of really supporting their work to the strongest way that we possibly could, and got engaged in this political fight, in this funding fight. But for the purpose of delivering something useful out of my leadership experience with this, I would say that, you know, one obvious answer is that money and power can matter more than good intentions or good programs. Having a spotlight on you can be good. It can be not so good. As trends change, as the political winds change, there will be different ways in which the funding flows. There'll be different ways in which programs get high profile or shoved to the corner. The other organization that we were dealing with, that we were basically in competition with, didn't really offer a value add, but they did have a lot more clout than us, and that mattered more. So that's something that I think is political and is a reality, no matter what work, prevention work you're engaged in. I guess as I've reflected on all this over time, I realized there's a couple of lessons that were important for me. And one was to trust and hang on to the values that underpin your work. Programs come and go, organizations come and go, trends come and go, but those values are evergreen. They will be there in your work and someone else's work. They always create opportunities to advance the field, to advance the work, to serve the mission, and to provide the support and resources to the folks in the community who are getting the work done. And my values, or the values in this situation, were really to be community informed and community driven, to use your platform to elevate those without power, to build for the long term, to fight the good fight, but walk away when the time comes, and to know there's always more work to be done. And some losses are tough, but it's really not you. It's not about you. It wasn't about me. It wasn't personal. It felt personal at the time. It was just the flow of history as it played out in this specific situation. And that was sort of the values that I felt were really, and the lessons that I felt that I learned from that scenario that I painted. But my thought for the field at this moment is a little bit different. And it has to do with sort of where we are. in the larger arc of history. And in terms of the work that I'm doing now as a volunteer, no longer a paid employee, but as a very heart-driven volunteer, the work I'm doing with Look, Listen, and Learn has reinforced for me, if we are not centering our work on racial equity, we are really not doing the right work of the moment. And the final thing I'd want to say is, and this is more related to the moment, the COVID moment we're in, is throughout my professional life, prevention was like a dirty word. People didn't say the P word. There was always the focus on the end result and never on the precipitating causes. In this COVID environment, we are hearing and understanding a lot more about prevention. And so maybe there's a hidden benefit for the prevention field in this, that indeed we can shift our focus and attention upstream back to the community, to the families who need relief from the challenges they're experiencing, and that prevention no longer will be the sort of hidden, secret, dirty word that it seemed to be in the many years that I tried to advocate for the prevention of child abuse and neglect and the promotion of child and family well-being.
Thank you, Joan. And our final guest for today is Kevin Haggerty.
I'm Kevin Haggerty. I'm the director of the University of Washington Social Development Research Group. And it's a really interesting question when you ask about my leadership experience, because it ranges from directing research centers and also directing different research projects and research studies, different kinds of groups of people kind of coming together to make a difference in some constructive kind of way. So it's from smaller groups that I've been leading to larger organizations and larger kind of affiliations of folks. So kind of a broad range of leadership capacity.
Thanks, Kevin. Welcome. And what story do you have to share with us today?
If I think about this, I'm thinking about when I was leading a particular project with a lot of moving parts and different interventions. It had interventions in schools and classrooms and the community. So there were a lot of different elements. Coming into a project-related meeting feeling incredibly stressed, a high level of anxiety, and feeling like I had to have my thumb on the pulse of everything, and it all fell on me. And as I got into the meeting and looked at the people around me, and that these were very seasoned, experienced people, I realized I wasn't allowing them to actually do what they do best. Like my propensity to have control and want to do it all and kind of micromanage and keep it all intact was getting in the way of them actually doing what they do best and helping them do their best work. And it was one of those just really big aha moments for me where I had to go, wow, I have to allow people to do the work they're supposed to do. So one of the things that's been a real struggle for me always in my leadership role is, how do you allow people to bring their best selves forward and to do the work that they're meant to do without getting in the way? And sometimes I found that getting out of the way is the most important thing. To be there to support them, to do the best work that they know how to do, is really kind of the thing I feel most successful at when I can be successful. So instead of trying to micromanage the pieces, one of my colleagues has reminded me often that my job is to stay focused on the big picture, to keep that big picture in mind, and to really keep your eye on the prize and focus on the big vision, the big picture of where we're going, and then people will get the small pieces and put them in place. So for me, I think the story is allowing people to do their job. And for me as a leader, to allow people to do what they do best. Oh, there's so many things I've learned about myself as a leader from a lot of different experiences. One, just allowing people to do their best work, but also really thinking about how am I supporting people to do their best work and what can I do to either get out of their way or support them. So that's, I think, been some important reflections that I've had in my life.
Thank you, Kevin. I'd like to again thank all of our guests for joining today and sharing their wisdom with us. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to sharing more with you in our next episodes.